Welcome to another NWR Book Project interview. I'm Jonathan Metz, and I'm here with a dear old friend who I'm talking to for really the first time ever, Mr. Justin Nation.
Hello.
Hey, Justin. And it's not that I never wanted to talk to you before. I just never really had the opportunity. Back when you and I worked together back in the very early 2000s, Skype didn't exist, and there weren't many alternative programs that did similar things. So we chatted a lot and we emailed a lot and we worked together quite a bit back in the day. But then, you know, you kind of left the site before I started doing podcasting and stuff like that. And so this is our first time we never got to meet in person for, you know, we can discuss some of that too later on. But, sure. I'm excited to finally actually get to talk to you in real time.
Yeah.
After knowing you for like 15 years.
Yeah, well, and that's sort of the thing of everybody. I mean, aside from Max, I've never met anybody face-to-face. Part of my saga of never capitalizing on what I actually did. You know, like, never was able to go to E3, never, you know, just always sort of, always a bridesmaid, never a bride.
Do you kind of... Well, I guess at the time that you were involved with the site, did you feel like an outsider? Or, I mean, I feel like the experience you had back then was, there were a lot of people in that situation who weren't able to travel or, you know, weren't involved with certain kind of more group activities that some people got to participate in.
Somewhat, but I mean, I don't know. I was always, like, even when I look at outcomes, and I mean, first, I think I was a bit older than a lot of folks, so
yeah.
You know, where I was in my life was a bit different, but then contributing to why I sort of started leaving, having a family and stuff, so you know, a lot of the reasons that I never really did any of it were, you know, I was doing my own different thing.
Mm-hmm.
With a family and all, so it never... It was one of those things that it rarely bugged me, but it was like every once in a while somebody would give some story about something that happened to E3, and it's like, oh man,
I don't want to rub it in, but I'm sure you have had an awesome time, and I would have loved to have had you out there. I could say the one time where I really felt that you were there in spirit at E3 was when Billy called a couple of us. It was Rick Powers and I think probably Max that year too, and maybe one other person called us up to his hotel room at E3 and opened up this package and said, I've got something for you guys. And he had these polo shirts with the Planet GameCube logo knit into them, and he said, Tammy Nation made these for you guys.
Yep.
And I was like, that is insane. And we all put them on and we wore them to the Nintendo party that day. And so they were seen by, you know, Shigeru Miyamoto and people like that.
That's sweet.
So you were there in a way. I mean, certainly your wife's handiwork were. And I think I still have that shirt. I don't wear it often because whenever I have like really old clothes with some kind of sentimental value, I tend to not wear them very often because I'm afraid I'm going to wear them out if I launder them too much. But I think I've held on to that one. It was really cool. I couldn't believe it. That was our first merch.
Yeah, well, and that
not
weird
really
thing
merch because it wasn't for sale, but yeah. You know what I mean.
But that really weird thing of, and I think that was always what was weird about the site in every sense of, like, trying to not be just, you know, some fanboy, trying to get scraped to get legitimacy or try to do things that made it seem like, you know, it was the real deal. It wasn't just, you know, a bunch of idiots writing some stuff. Well, it sort of was, but, you know, scraping for legitimacy,
right?
With places that were real and people getting paid, and yeah, that was always kind of the fight.
Did you feel that we were in competition with like professional websites that provided similar kind of coverage, like IGN, GameSpot, etc.?
I mean, with all the ones I work on, sort of, but not really. I mean, N64 HQ, you know, and so the gig that I got in,
mm-hmm. that, legendary in 64.
Yeah, I mean,
website.
And that was before, and that was at the same time IGN was starting. So, you know, then much more so, it was sort of cool. But then, you know, as it got into 64 Source in 2000, all these, it was always different. I mean, I didn't really think of it as competing, because to me, the tone and what we were trying to do was just slightly different. Especially for me, I always like to shoot my mouth off. So editorial content wise, I thought we were more honest, there always seemed to be an agenda when I'd read stuff for IGN, or they wouldn't talk about certain things, or they
were playing by the rules, right? And we didn't really have to. That was part of it, is that they had a certain level of access and like official capacity that we didn't have. But at the same time, that sort of tied their hands in certain ways that we didn't have to worry about.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I would just shoot my mouth off about whatever. And nobody was going to come talk to us, or, you know, I mean, not really. I mean, nobody was giving it. Well, most of the time when I was doing it, that was before. Most of the time I did it, that we were buying our own game. I mean, we were getting nothing. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, we owed nothing to anybody. So, yeah, there was no fear of, if we say that, that's really not going to go over well. Well, we're not getting anything anyway, so we might as well just be honest. So that always made it a tougher thing. I mean, I don't know. And each site had its own flavor, and there were differences, and I would say, you know, the end, N64, Planet GameCube. You know, once it got to that, I would say that was more, you know, competing with the likes of IGN in terms of its setup and what it was doing. I'd say the earlier incarnations that I was involved in, they were all sort of different flavors and tried different things, some not successfully. Yeah, I'd say Billy's was more straightforward, trying to go for that same kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. When you were back working for the N64 HQ, or then when you started 64 Source or Operation in 2000, probably the latter one less so, but for the N64 sites, did you have any direct contact with Nintendo? Were you talking with their PR company? Were you requesting, you know, quotes or press releases or review copies or things like that? Or was it just completely underground punk, you know, just we do our own thing and fuck the man and whatever?
I can't speak for N64 HQ just because I don't know what Scott McCall and Mike were doing. And really, I came on sort of late on in that whole thing, writing editorials and doing reviews. But then 64 Source, I wasn't really interested in, I didn't have the time and I didn't really have the inclination to try to make cold calls to, you know, try to figure out how to even approach, you know, mm-hmm. the right people. To me, there was no clear way that I could easily do that. And it felt, you know, even when I thought about doing it, it felt like I had nothing really to offer them. So I never even reached out, and nobody brought it up. I think that was a matter of I'm not very marketing minded. So the fact that somebody could be getting games or have actual contact with Nintendo or some of these other companies, it really didn't occur to me, or at least I wouldn't have known how to go about it. Mm-hmm. So, and then most of the people that we had come along, there were, you know, we're a bunch of college students. I mean,
yeah, people with, you know, people with an education and a lot of free time and who were probably just the right age to have grown up with Nintendo and want to do something about it.
Yeah. I mean, I was blown away that, you know, when people could go to E3, I was just blown away by that. And perhaps, you know, perhaps if I was in the earlier time, if I'd had time to do something like go to E3, then it would have been easier. Then you can make the contacts and you can meet the people that it would take to get that kind of thing going. Mm-hmm. But when I was doing it, there was no money, there was no nothing, there was no games, nothing. It was just, you were just obsessed with Nintendo, and we're gonna share everything we know about it. And I don't even think there was a objective behind it other than just doing it.
Just because it was fun.
Yeah. 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 Once I got the bug, writing the stuff for N64 HQ, and I wrote, I got some freelance, nothing much, but, I got some freelance offers. Briefly was trying to write a few reviews for GamePro. Wrote an article. I kept my copy of Next Generation. I had one article that spun out of Operation 2000 for that. Since I was in college and it was just interesting and it had come from nothing. That's why 64 Source sort of got started. It was like, N64 HQ meant a lot to me, and it was this opportunity, and I got a platform that people were actually reading, and it was interesting. It was like, this is a shame for there not to be that outlet for people. So once I was able to get a couple people from N64 HQ interested, and then basically just sent out a cold call to anybody who'd respond, and that was how Max and Rob Stevens got, they sent me their application with some writing samples, and we got going. So it's just, like I said, I never had a objective in mind. It was just, this is neat. This is interesting. I think it's important people have an opportunity to do something like this. I'll try to back it.
I think it's important, something that you just kind of glazed over a little bit, but the fact that you, when you went off to start your own website in the absence of N64 HQ and in the wake of the impact that site had, which was really kind of like the forerunner of so many, not just Nintendo websites, but, it kind of created a model in the very early days of the internet of how to do this stuff and got people interested and kind of planted the idea that it could be done. But I like the idea that you went off and started your own website kind of in the model of the previous one. And even these people that you had worked with before at the previous website, you had them provide samples and fill out some kind of application, and you had some kind of process even to put this together. And that's something that, when I was director of Planet GameCube, I had similar things, but I inherited a lot of that stuff, and I just tried to make improvements and do things my way. But did you have any experience with that kind of management atmosphere before? Had you learned those skills in any kind of formal setting, or was it just something that felt like you just needed to do it, and so you just figured out how to do it?
In terms of sort of dopey lame kind of stuff that happens in life, I worked at Little Caesars, and through circumstances, my whole life has been circumstances put you in an opportunity where things happen. Through a bunch of weird circumstances. At 16, I was an assistant manager, basically, through a series of events. So I'd gotten experience. At one point I was, 16, telling 18-year-olds what to do kind of thing, and which was an odd experience, but I never had a problem, maybe I'm a persuasive kind of person. Mm-hmm. I never had a hard time working with people or getting them to work with me, because I usually try to be pretty reasonable. You have to set a standard. And then at the time I was pursuing I was an English major. So the editing part of it also made sense. And it made sense that, I'd had to go through a process to get into N64 HQ. I'd submitted writing samples to Scott McCall, and that process made sense. It's like,
so they had a protocol as well.
Yeah. Yeah. That was 20 years ago. I don't remember how hard I had to work to get into N64 HQ. And I don't remember a lot of that time, but I had to go through a process, cause they had an open call for people, submitted an application. Yeah, that all made sense.
In what ways would you say that the 64 source, your own website, was different from N64 HQ? Was there anything that you intentionally wanted to be different about it, or were there just, you know, were there some things that occurred just kind of out of happenstance, or because it was a somewhat different combination of people, or whatever?
I think I was trying to take what they did and go further. In particular, we had a lot of we tried to do the international thing, because N64 HQ, you had Gazunta doing the Australian stuff, you had Ravi doing Japanese stuff. Mm-hmm. Was able to keep Ravi. Love Ravi.
That's Ravi Haranon. Who does he still work at CNN? I know he did for a long time.
I watch his updates on Facebook, everyone, but he's irregular on it. So,
okay.
I used to talk with him. Well, not talk. I used to, you know, we used to have heated debates on chat of some kind. But it's been a while.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. I mean, we brought along Brian Dawson,
right.
Ty
Shirt. Yeah.
So I mean, we had a lot of folks. But so, you know, we had somebody who was in Europe at one point. I think her name was Carly.
Of course, yeah, Carly Jung, who's I think still occasionally involved with NWR. I think she's mostly retired now, but she's been around for a long time, and I worked with Carly a bunch when I was running the site.
So, I mean, I tried to keep that kind of thing going, which was an odd experience because, you know, release dates are one thing to manage. It's hard to sometimes get information out of the different markets and make it digestible. And really the readership, I don't think, was primarily international. So whether or not that had a lot of value, it was just something different. But also there was an editorial that sort of got me going on N64 HQ. It was critical of how people wrote reviews. And that was the one where I think Dan Emmerich was one of the industry folks who sent me email about that. I'd actually gotten a lot of response about it. So that sort of gave me a perspective, because it was about, you know, when you write a review, who are you writing the review for? Who are you in terms of, you know, your approach to the game? Because it was about, you know, when you write something, you know, what you're interested in and what you're shooting for, what the audience you're trying to reach, all affects how effective your review is. So I tried to really have almost a specialization kind of thing. So Brian Dawson was a huge fighting game fan. So we tried to sort of say, you know, this is our resident X person. So Brian Dawson's a fighting game person. So if it's possible, we really should have him review any given fighting game or, you know, something from the genre. And then you should have somebody else who's maybe not a true fighting game fan review the game as well.
Hmm.
Because, you know, him reviewing the game is a different thing than somebody who's more mainstream focused reviewing the game. And it's
useful for different audience, right? Because, you know, if you don't play every single fighting game, then the way a guy like Brian would approach the game and the kinds of things that he would be critiquing or praising might be hard to even understand. You know, there could be a lot of lingo, there could be a lot of comparisons to other games that you haven't played, etc. So yeah, I know that's something that we always struggled with at the Planet too, was how much, you know, how much expertise should a reviewer have for a given kind of game? And some, you know, sometimes there's just games that no one has expertise with, or it's a new kind of game and no one could have expertise. But like, how much is enough? How much is too much? And how can we get different perspectives on things that are distinct and useful to people? And that's how there were some games that we had, you know, four or five different reviews of. And some of them, you know, to some extent, they might have been redundant with each other, but they would always, you'd always get some kind of different angle because it was always coming through someone's personality and experiences. And I always felt like, well, it's a lot of resources. It's a lot of time and energy to have multiple people review a game. And for maybe some games don't merit that degree of effort, but for some things, it can be really helpful, I think.
Yeah, and I always thought that was a big difference because IGN, there's the one review or game,
right.
GameSpot.
And there it's like it represents the entire website's opinion, basically.
Yep.
Like, I think in the old days, maybe they didn't even have bylines for their reviews. It just said, this was the IGN review. Maybe they had multiple people kind of contribute and mix together their opinions or different statements that they had about it. But it was like, you know, I think they didn't even used to like credit themselves, you know, like you didn't even know exactly who wrote a given review.
Well, and which was a shame on multiple levels because you lost that personality. You lost that. And that even extended to us reporting news. Cause I mean, obviously, all sites, a primary piece of it is just aggregating the same news that everybody else has.
Mm-hmm.
And with 64 Source, we had this whole weird thing that every staffer had like their own color scheme. So I think mine was blue on gray, and Max was like red on some. And so for news, it was almost, and this was almost like predating the way forum stuff works, where something gets posted and the reader sort of, you know, go off on tangents and have these discussions about the latest news. We did that in the news page almost for the staff. So you'd see, you know, the base, you know, I would post the news and we would try to, we would try to do the thing, you know, we're trying to have integrity. We would try to post the news as itself, the actual news with no editorializing, and then, you know, then you'd bring your opinion to it. And the thing is, and that's where, you know, Rob and Max became, you know, these major personalities, at least in terms of my interaction, because they didn't have a lot of time either, or, you know, they had a lot of time to give to the site as well as I did. So, you know, these news, sometimes you'd have this sort of back and forth argument almost and tied directly to the news, not down buried in the forum. You know, we'd post the news and then you'd see this, you know, this argument sort of between staffers of, you know, oh, I think this is important. Oh, yeah, you're full of it. Or, you know, and it was just this weird, thing that I don't think you really ever see. So, you know, rather than it being just, you know, the readers and stuff like that, I mean, you had the staff, you know, just putting it out there, just, you know, disagreeing or having our own opinions. And so, you know, so again, unlike a major site like IGN, it seems the goal is to present a unified front, you know, that there is only this one opinion, even if it's only one staffer's, nobody's dissenting on that opinion generally, unless they have like a feature. But, you know, everything was up for debate. Everything was up for whoever wanted to contribute or say something, you know, knock yourself out. And like I said, you see that now in forums and stuff like that, certainly. But for the staffers, I think it was more important to have it right there. Because, you know, the goal is, you know, my voice or Max's voice, or, you know, that we people get used to what we say or the way we say things. So, you know, it sort of is a reinforcement of that. You know, this person's opinion hopefully matters, and hopefully people follow what they say to some degree, and they may not agree or they may agree or disagree, but the goal was to get that name out there and to get the person out there and get their personality out there and have people identify with it. So, I mean, you know, it was different.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, and you do see it now still. Like I said, now that kind of thing tends to happen down in the forums and stuff like that. And then it opens up to readers, which is also interesting. But what, maybe 25% of your readership probably buries into the forums? I don't know. I mean,
I think it's probably less than 10%. And that's just for our site, but for any site.
So a lot of people are missing out on that extended experience is sort of what's the shame.
Yeah. So. Well, you know, I guess with 64 Source, and I used to run an N64 site, so I have some sense of you know, what the environment was like, what the level of discourse was, what the, you know, the amount of material out there to give coverage to, was very different than for the N2000, which, you know, we later knew as the GameCube. But in the early days, long before the launch of that system, you started a site called Operation N2000. And what led to the transition from 64 Source to OPN 2000, and how did you find the experience to be different? I mean, within 2000, there's just there wasn't much to go on. It was almost, these were like speculation websites as much as anything, and I would think that'd be a very different experience for you.
That I and when I started that site, I pretty much stopped. I mean, well, I still would contribute to 64 source, but I really left it to Max for the most part.
There
And
wouldn't have been as much to cover in the late 90s anyway for N64.
yeah. And my focus, I was really focused on the N2000, and it was, and it could have just been a, look at the scraps of news, rumor monger, potentially make up your own rumors just for the hell of it. But we didn't want to do that. And it was a weird exercise, and that's where I got the 1 gig. What is it? Next Generation picked up the developer profile thing that I had done, where the it was almost like a mix of a investigative journalism slash creative writing experiment, where you'd take so Rare, or some major developer, and you'd look at sort of their body of work, and then break down what's the status of the relationship with Nintendo. What would they bring to the table? What could you hope to see? So it was very speculative, and it didn't act like it was anything but speculative. I mean, we weren't trying to make any claims. And then there was the Dream Games thing, where it was a fun sort of exercise of okay, well, we're going to have this new horsepower. We have this body of games that Nintendo's made. What's a way? It's like a game development exercise to say, given this new platform with more power, how could you change this game and make a better one? I'm still pissed that Nintendo has not made an updated version of Pokemon Snap based on my dream game. Nintendo would be able to make their own version of a first person shooter, because you're shooting camera pictures instead of shooting the Pokemon. It would be nice to, nail Pikachu in the head with a headshot once in a while, but instead, make it family friendly. But yeah, the thought of a photo safari thing, and with the Wii U controller, with the being able to move it around, you'd think it could almost work.
Well, and it could still.
Oh
I
yeah.
suppose it's not too late for that to
Yeah,
happen, but.
I expect my byline in there if they use that idea.
Special thanks in the credits.
for dreaming big.
I've been chuckling to myself as you talk about this stuff because things like developer profiles and Dream Games, I know of them as Planet GameCube features. These were things that I was attracted to when I was deciding, whether I wanted to work for the site, and there were things I got to contribute to after I joined the staff. And I didn't really have the history. I would suspect a lot of the staff and the readership didn't necessarily know where these ideas came from. I didn't even know that they were the thing, things that you had come up with at OPN2K.
And that was, I don't remember what percentage of things were written. But I would imagine the majority of the developer profile and Dream Games were probably written by me. Like I said, other people probably would have contributed, but when Operation 2000 was going, I don't think a lot of people were working. I mean, because there really was so little, and it really was, you had to make the content. So, I think I was mostly, I mean, I had people when we did have news come along or something like that, we did get people come across and put in their input. But yeah, that was, to me, that whole site was an extended creative writing experiment. And it was interesting, and it was, and so, out of all the things that could be different than the mainstream sites, that is the most different. I mean, it was its own beast. But yeah, then we had, then the Rick Powers and the break of the Dolphin code name. I mean, so that got a lot of cash. That got a lot of interest going. Yeah, most of that site, for the majority of its existence, if we wanted to have an update, every day, every other day, we had to be doing something like the developer profile or the dream game because there was nothing. There was nothing else.
Yeah, you're starting from a blank page every time.
Yep.
Which is, that's really hard to do. As a writer, I can say that. That's quite a challenge.
But it was a lot. It was a lot of fun. And it was that chance to sort of show some chops of, you know, really taking a look, especially developer profiles. You had to spend some time and think about what they were doing and what and the type of thing they're doing, the status of their relationship with Nintendo, because you didn't just want to make some claim. So you had to sort of go through the news for the last, you know, year or two and assess the relationship. Mm-hmm. But yeah,
and you're doing research on, you know, the past games that they've done and how those were received and, you know, how those might fit with what your expectations were for this upcoming system, right?
Yeah.
Well, how did you end up merging Operation in 2000 with Planet in 2000? Because that's something that happened very... I didn't bring up the exact date. I'll have to do that later for the book. But that happened very close to when I started working for Planet in 2000. And at the time, I was... You know, like there were a lot of Nintendo sites at the time. So I was reading some, but not all of them. And I had heard of Operation in 2000, but I wasn't necessarily like a regular visitor or anything. And so for me, it was like, oh, now there's a lot of content being added to our site, which kind of beefed us up and made us like a much better sort of database. And there were all these people who seemed really talented, but I didn't really know any of them. And all of a sudden our staff like doubled in size. So how did that come about? And, you know, was that your idea? Was it Billy's idea? How did that all go down?
You might have to ask Billy. I don't remember if I'm thinking most likely he asked more so than I offered. Just because I don't know if when I was shutting everything down, I don't know if I was really thinking about what I was going to do with the content or anything like that. If I was seeking Billy out for it, I think it would make me seem more selfless than I probably was. But in terms of him asking, I don't imagine, and this is, again, it's so long ago, it's hard to, I don't imagine I gave him a hard time. I might have thought about it, but to me, I wouldn't have wanted to see the content die. So I would imagine I was pretty open to the idea in general. Not just my content, but anybody else's content, because, you know, especially in those days, you know, people say that everything on the internet is forever and you can't delete anything on the internet. Well, they didn't run their own site off of, off of something that they didn't host. Cause you know, back then, you know, Operation 2000 and those things existed, by being hosted by a company that I didn't have to pay for the site because, you know, basically I was part of their, I was on their site and, you know, we were part of some weird ad network. You know, there was some kind of thing. So I never wanted to have to pay for things. So, that was my one form of marketing, was trying to find a place that I could get hosting that would take care of all the bandwidth costs and stuff. So I didn't have to pay out of pocket. But in a situation like that, you know, once it dries up, that stuff's going to be gone. Now, nobody's going to have it.
Now we have, you know, even if that happens nowadays, there's the hope that something like the Internet Archive might have cached it and make some version of it available for people, you know, for posterity. But that didn't, I don't think that even existed back in like 1999. If it did, it wasn't well publicized. So that's not something you could have relied upon.
No, I think the front page of Operation 2000 is still there when we were shutting down. I think that is there, but yeah, nothing's there. And the shame is, one of the things that people liked early on about that site, it's one of those silly things of, again, a marketing thing. I was taking some design classes. I learned Shockwave, and I actually made, the logo for Operation 2000 on the splash page. When people come in, it was flash and it was a animation. Mm. The letters would like, you know, swirl around, do whatever. And that was one of those things that, you know, helped people like, oh, wow, that's cool. You know,
that's very much like web 1.0 days.
Yes, exactly. Like, oh, wow, this splash page is awesome. I should be reading this site. But it's funny how those things work. But yeah, I'm disappointed that the one thing that that the archive, you know, it has the front page. So I can see how horribly clunky it looked. But I don't even get to see the cool logo. But yeah, they're all that stuff would have been dead, and I knew it was going to be dead. So like I said, between my work and the work of other people who'd worked with me and, you know, put in a lot of time, you didn't want to see all that stuff just disappear. That wasn't fair. So it made sense. It was like, you know, now this stuff can live on, and that's cool. And I didn't have a huge connection to Billy. It was just one of those things where he had been on N64HQ, so I knew tangentially, and had talked to him probably once or twice. And he'd done his own thing when I did 64 Source. So, you know, knew he was out there kind of thing. So, yeah, if I had to try to put together what I can remember, he probably said, hey, you know, we have a site, you know, you want to throw your stuff over here? And that's how I'd imagine it progressed. And
yeah, it's a chance for your hard work to live on, you know, at least as an archive.
Mm-hmm.
For what it's worth, the About Nintendo World Report page at our website, which I think I wrote a good portion of this, although it was a very long time ago, and it looks like it's been updated by someone else since then. But it does say that it says that Operation in 2000 closed up shop around the spring or summer of 1999.
Is that right?
And it says that Billy asked Justin if he could move OPN 2000's content over to Planet in 2000. Justin obliged and became a member of the staff, as did a few other people from the closing site. Yet most of the staff was rather skeptical that Planet in 2000 would go anywhere. at the time when you joined Billy's website, what do you remember about that time? What were your feelings about it? Was it a relief to not be in charge of everything yourself at that point, or were you concerned about having to sort of answer to someone else who was kind of running the show?
I know what I knew of the site at the time was, and so this is coming from the perspective of, you know, having, you know, try to generate my own content, having been in the creative bent and not even doing 64 Source for a while. What Billy had was much more traditional. It was, you know, news aggregation with some like commentary, some reviews and that kind of thing. So at the time that I was getting involved with it, it was probably just sort of like, well, you know, how's this going to shake out? More, you know, I'm not really sure how it was going to work out. In terms of not being in charge, I think we worked pretty well together, because Billy was always open to ideas. Like when we got rumors going with Louis the Cat, which was probably one of my favorite things that we ever did. And I remember, I think it was some friend of Max's was the one that actually made the original drawings or whatever for the different ratings. So, you know, at the time, it was very collaborative, at least for between Billy and I. So I think it was one of those things where I didn't, you know, and the reason I'd stopped Operation 2000 was because of having a kid on the way, and I knew I wasn't going to keep be able to run sites and do all that. So it was a big relief to not have all that to worry about, but to still have this outlet to be able to do this stuff. And yeah, we collaborated quite a lot. It was a lot of fun figuring out the Louis the Cat stuff. That was a blast. And we had fun writing, you know, coming up with this voice of Louis, this AOL speak kind of weird broken English.
Yeah, hacker speak.
Yeah. That was fun. And you know, I think when we usually wrote something with him, it passed through a couple people trying to punch it up and, you know, make it more obnoxious or give it more personality. So yeah, there was a lot of collaboration and stuff. So I don't think I ever felt like it was a problem. It was always a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's good to hear. And I'm not surprised, but it you could imagine that two websites kind of merging, and especially two staffs merging, could lead to some problems. But I certainly my memory of it is that it was harmonious, and after a while you couldn't really tell, who came from OPN 2000, who was already at the planet before that, who had been hired on after that. It didn't really seem to matter that much, because the early days of the website, especially, it wasn't really about what have you done in the past. It's what can you do today? Who's available to work and who's going to do the best job right now? And, oh, it's cool. You used to work for that site. I used to read that. I didn't know you worked there. Awesome. That's like a connection, but it doesn't necessarily give you seniority over someone else or anything like that.
Yeah, at the end of the day, it's who can get in, who can get something in by, the afternoon to cover so we have an update today.
So, Justin, I know you wrote a lot for not only, your own sites before joining the planet and afterward. I would say you were one of the more prolific writers in the early days, and were behind a lot of the big features and the things that the site was well known for. But I also, when I think back to you, I think of you as the guy who made the website. I know it wasn't that way at first, but how did you end up doing the at least the back end coding, if not the actual like front page layout and design of the website?
That was and that gets into the whole chronology of the perils and awesome things about the way fate works with your life. I was working doing some programming. I'd always been doing web development. I took a grad class that was about Cold Fusion and using SQL to build dynamic websites. And at work, I was bored. I was horribly bored. In order to make an impression at work, to try to to show what I could do, because there weren't really opportunities where I was at in the vein of what I was interested in doing, to show what I had to offer. So Cold Fusion seemed interesting. I didn't know anything about databases at the time. I didn't know anything about Cold Fusion at the time, but hey, I took a grad class and I did a simple site. So I'm going to build a website. That's going to be awesome. Probably just sort of threw it out there to Billy, like, hey, would you be interested if I could, make this thing automated? Would you be interested? And so I don't really even remember how it all shook out, but it got to the point of I'm gonna do this.
Yeah, and I think up to that point, we had some kind of layout that Billy had probably made himself in Front Page. And then I do recall for a few months when I first started, we were using some kind of service called NewsFront or something like that. And it was like a form that you filled out, and you would write your article in Microsoft Word or Notepad or something, and you would paste it in there, and you would put it all in this form, and then like a couple hours later or something, it would pop up on the website. And I was like the new kid, and I didn't know how any of this stuff worked. I was used to writing my site in like GeoCities and Page Builder and then like HTML before that. So I didn't know how any of this stuff worked. And for me, it was like, oh, I guess this is how the big boys do it, but I think it was some kind of service that Billy was subscribing to that would like format stuff and like probably shove it into the layout template that he had made in Front Page. So it was kind of like a messy, crude way of doing things up until your original green version of the website.
Well, and if you want even hackier, when 64 Source was going, I actually had created a JavaScript template. I wrote this, and I sent it out to all the people on staff. And you'd sort of pick, I'm doing a news story, and you'd fill out a form like you're talking about. But when they hit the button, it would actually generate the HTML for the page that would get uploaded to the site. So I'd sort of optimize this method of them creating their own version, creating their own articles, HTML using this JavaScript template, and then they'd email it to me, and then I could FTP it onto the server manually.
Sure.
So yeah, I'm familiar with that. That whole, you know, we'd done some hackery.
Funny enough, this was several years later, but I eventually learned how to do something similar to that with Fortran. Yeah, it was. I had to develop a GUI, a graphical user interface, for quick and easy non-technical person to input a bunch of parameters into a very, very complicated, powerful Fortran algorithm. And Fortran, the way that I was working from legacy code that someone else had written, and so it was designed to read an input file, as you know, just a text file, and then that would drive the engine of all the math and everything that it was going to be doing. And so the way that I handled the GUI was I figured out how to have Fortran take all the inputs from the GUI and format its own input file from all that stuff. And I don't know anything about JavaScript, but I guarantee you doing it in Fortran is worse. I promise you it's worse.
I believe it.
But yeah, that's just funny. I just had like flashbacks as you were describing that process.
So once we got it up and going, there was a whole effort to, we had to convert the existing site to move the, I think we did that all in a weekend to, jeez, you know, populate this new version of the site with the old stuff. That took forever. That was a heavily manually driven exercise. But that was that thing, you know, so that thing of how it affects your life. I actually did show company that I was working for at the time, that and a couple other projects I'd done during college, just to try to say, hey, see, I can do some of these other really cool, more ambitious things. And they, it was probably a collection of other things too, but they used that partially to fire me because they thought I was working on the side, I guess.
Really? So they weren't impressed. They didn't take it as a positive thing at all.
Well, and I think they knew I was bored. So yeah, like I said, there were probably other factors, but yeah, that was sort of the nail in my coffin of them firing me. But hey, that is what resulted in me getting my job that I have now. So, and went from Cold Fusion, you know, co-developer to the director. So yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's that funny thing of, I think probably a lot of people have site stories around the site in different ways, some more major than others, that it changed certain parts of your life. I mean, for better or worse, that people have, you know, stuff has happened. You know, there's benefit to these things where you knew it or at the time or not.
So you could say that job you definitely lost because of stuff that you were doing for the website, but the job that followed, the one that you have now, would you say that working on the website helped you get that job?
Oh yeah, very much so. Because that was, you know, it's a little weird going into an interview to sort of give your establish your coding credentials to say, yeah, I created the code that's running a game website. I mean, so I'm sure there was a certain level of okay, so, you know, is he really going to be focused on doing our stuff, or is he going to be working on this website? But yeah, it definitely, it was something that I could show that I'd done. And then just the experience of, I taught myself SQL heavily during, you know, going through all the motions of trying to figure out how to organize the information. And, you know, so whoever inherited that poor original code, I apologize to them profusely, because I think even within like 2 years when I was looking at it, it was just like, oh, this is just garbage.
Yeah, you and TYP should really have like a long dinner conversation sometime about that, because he wasn't the only one who ended up sort of inheriting it and modifying it and maturing it. But I would say TYP has probably spent as much time as anybody looking at the SQL coding that you did back in the early days.
Poor person. Yeah,
and
he
didn't know much about it at the time either. So he was kind of, I think, self-teaching and
oh,
you know, learning
good
about it along the way. So, okay, you know, I'm sure he's sympathetic.
That's good. Because, yeah, if it was me even 5 years ago trying to walk into that, looking at it, it would just be like, what the hell is this stuff?
Yeah,
I
but
can't
I'm
believe
glad you
that.
brought up that, and for people who might not be familiar with SQL, that's, it's a, I think Microsoft owns the technology, I guess, but it's SQL, and it's a, based on my very rudimentary understanding, it's a language that you can use to design a database. And the significance of that is that Planet in 2000, up to that point, was basically a blog. The word blog didn't exist at the time, but it was like a news blog. It was we put up daily news. The archive was very rudimentary. You could probably scroll backward and look at things from days earlier, but I doubt that that was a very elegant process. And it wasn't set up for us to be posting different kinds of pages. It wasn't really it wasn't like a repository of information where you could say, well, I wonder what I can find about the new Zelda game that's coming out for that system. If you just went there, you could maybe do some kind of search, but even back then, the search functionality tended to not be very good within a website. So it would have been hard to find anything specific, and it would have been difficult for us to post anything other than a sort of very generic looking news story. And so the thing that I think was so special and memorable and lasting about the first, again, the classic like green Planet in 2000 website that you created is that it was set up more like what you would now think of as like Wikipedia. It was this encyclopedia of information, and you could go to, I mean, it was like tied together by things like game profiles, where for any given game that may or may not even exist, maybe it's just something that's rumored to exist, you could go there, and all of the different kinds of articles, from news to rumors to previews to reviews to screenshots, etc., would all be relationally linked to this one place so that you could kind of branch out from there. And it led to our site becoming this very deep reserve of information of all different kinds about all different kinds of games. And it made our website very sticky because if you wanted to go and learn about something in particular, you could follow these links and could sort of go in this, you could go down like the Wikipedia well, that people understand now. You could just sort of start following links within the website and learn all kinds of stuff because it existed as more of it like a web framework of information rather than just a list of articles sort of chronologically.
No, and now there was always the downside is the person who had to fill stuff out because like if you were the one that had to fill in the basic information to get a new company up, kind of a pain in the ass. Because you had to somebody had to actually look up all this crap. It's like, oh my God, I've got to fill in these different fields. I think I even originally when I was setting it up, I think I even had like ticker symbols and crap that and the idea was I could even click on the ticker symbol for Konami, and it would take me to the Motley Fool website that would, show me how their stock's doing. So there was like this overambitious side to me too. It was like, you'd get to company. Well, what is every kind of thing that I could imagine I'd want to know about the company? And so initially, that's sort of what I was doing is filling in all these different fields. And now I don't even remember how much of it lived because there were even concepts like, there are developers and there are publishers. So, there are different companies that are associated with a game. And, so Rare is the developer, but Nintendo is the publisher. So there's these, so even, it's not even a one-to-one relationship with a lot of these things. There are several companies. Yeah, it
Overlapping
was.
categories and all kinds of like optional fields. I remember putting in release dates, you kind of had to learn a syntax for how to enter those. So like if you knew a game was coming out in quarter three of 2002, but you didn't have an exact date for it, then there was some kind of code that you would put in that would translate in the database. So that when you posted the page, it would show up as quarter three.
Yeah, it was that, yeah, because it was you had to put in the date so that it would sort correctly chronologically, and then I must have put in a filter that was specifically looking for that one format to then turn it into Q4 2004 or something like that. Yeah, that all makes sense.
It sounds aggravating now, but at the time it was so cool. I mean, the website, there was a degree of functionality and usefulness to the website that I think was very rare. And it may it's I think it's a big part of why our website became so popular, because all of a sudden it was like we were the right place at the right time. We had, this sort of this swelling interest in what Nintendo was doing with their new system, and also this swell of people having access to the internet and becoming active on the internet for the first time in a lot of cases. And people who'd grown up with Nintendo wanted to know what's going on with Nintendo. What can I use the internet for that will help me become more engaged with Nintendo? And you'd go to a lot of websites and it would just be sort of random stuff, or it would be, here's all my best times for Mario Kart 64, and here's some, here's like a random game guide or something. And then our website felt it felt like we were at least attempting to be comprehensive. We just had every kind of information that we could find about every game that we could think of. And it felt like once you found that place, you didn't really need to go to a lot of other places. You could just, it was like a one-stop shop. And there just wasn't any, this was back before, I mean, this was before Nintendo's own website really had this kind of information, much less all the other game publishers and developers that we were writing about. No, this was long before the days where every single game got its own website. Every game company had its own blog where they would share screenshots with you and tell you all about the game and have their own corporate PR people sort of tell you about why this game was going to be cool. That stuff just didn't exist on the internet at the time. So there was a huge value in sort of assembling all this different kind of information, putting it in one place and making it easy for the user to get to all of it and to just sort of discover different kinds of coverage that we were generating. That was a really big deal. Did
You're
what?
much better at the marketing part than I am. It's a dumb site. Yeah, no, I agree with all of it. Just, yeah.
What kind of feedback were you getting from the site at the time, like from the staff who had to use it to enter all this information, and from the people using the website? What did you hear about it?
From the staff, I mean, there would be some grumbliness every once in a while, because even when it even probably 6 months in to it being in place, there were still either bugs or issues that the back end would have. But I think I think we try to at least I try to get them out of the way as quickly as possible, or at least come up with a workaround that people could use. But yeah, I think it was a big improvement over what a lot of people had been using. It was a bit slow. I remember that. And even the site was a bit slow at times. That was the thing. Since it was powered, it isn't a hosted HTML page, so you bring it up and it comes up immediately kind of thing. The more re readers that we got at a time during certain rush periods, I remember it would slow down. And the reason why is because it was generating it on the fly. There wasn't we hadn't like IGN and the big ones, they do all that sort of in advance and then sort of dump their entire site at once as HTML in a mass push, it always seemed was their model. At least that's what I understood of their model. And that's why at 8 o'clock is when when their stuff gets updated. So it truly
Yeah,
is
all their daily content would sort of go up at the same time. I do remember that.
versus us, it's all real time. If somebody comes in at 1:30 in the morning and post something, it's up. So there definitely was a cost.
Let me read the slogan to you, because I don't think it's changed in about 15 years. Right under the title of our website, the logo, Nintendo World Report, it says Worldwide Nintendo Coverage 24/7 365.
If somebody's bored and wants to post something, you have an update. Woo!
Yeah, well, you're part of the reason that we can actually make that claim.
You aren't. Well, because you're not prone to whoever owns the the two people that know the FTP website login to upload the HTML, which was the old model.
I think the implementation that you had, Justin, was really key in allowing, we had a large staff at the time. We still do, but at the time, I would say, we probably had 20, 25 people writing for the site at any given time. And it was very important that these people who a lot of whom would never meet each other, would never meet their editor, their person who hired them, their manager, whatever. It was important to have a way for them to access the site and be able to get their content into it easily without a lot of training, without having a lot of bottlenecks where they had to send it to, like you said, one or two people who actually had the technical know-how to get that stuff into the website. This was not like Facebook where you can just write whatever you want and put it up there and it all just sort of magically happens. I mean, updating a website back in the late 90s and early 2000s required a lot of actual technical know-how for the most part. And I remember being kind of amazed that you had this like hidden staff interface. We would go to a certain web page, we would log in, we had very official usernames and passwords and everything, and we would have our own special version of the website that allowed us to edit things and click on pages to add new stuff. And it was simple enough that anybody could join the staff, and within a couple of days, they could be posting their own content, and allowed us to update really often and utilize this really large staff of people with, very widely varied technical backgrounds. It sort of took away those barriers and just allowed us to operate on a much broader basis. And when it came to stuff like E3, which I do want to talk about a little bit, even though you've never been, the work that you did on the website made a tremendous difference with the way we were able to cover events like that, because we would roll in there with 15 people and every one of them could update the site simultaneously. And that made our website look a lot more effective than just about anybody else, because we were able to put things up so much faster and we could put up so much more stuff than everybody else who had brought two or three people to the show and they're all cranking out, as many articles as they can. It allowed us to use our numbers in a way that we had not been able to before that.
When you got an effect with that of it's almost like now when you have live blogs during things, but again, not just one person. You could get three different people posting something in short, quick succession, and you're not waiting until that 8 o'clock update. It's up now. Yeah, there was definitely that immediacy. Well, and then you had people like me. I mean, so my E3 was usually sitting and somebody, Billy or somebody emailing me or messaging me saying, oh, here's a site that's got a bunch of screenshots. We need to watermark and get these things up. So, I would get out my image modifier and manually run a script to put the little cheesy watermarks on everything and get them up on the site.
Well, and that's because stealing bandwidth was a real problem back then. People would just hot link to your screenshots. They would find the address of the file directly on your server, and they would post on some message board and just load up all the screenshots of a certain game. And so everyone who's at that message board could look at all of our screenshots that we had worked really hard to gather, upload, format, et cetera. In some cases, like curate, we would try to choose the best ones or whatever. But they were pulling, it was costing us money because they'd be hitting our server, but they weren't even looking at our webpage. They weren't looking at our ads. They weren't reading our coverage. They were just sort of abusing the work that we'd already done. And so watermarks were kind of an early attempt to at least give ourselves credit when people did that and make sure that people understood where this information was coming from, in the hopes that maybe they would actually seek out our website and try to find more. But yeah, watermarks were a real pain in the ass, from what I
Yes, they
recall
were.
back in the day.
Yeah, I'd found a free program that would let that you could script it. So if I had a folder full of them, I could at least. But yeah, originally, before I'd found that, yeah, I was sitting there freaking putting on a second layer and changing the transparency and.
Like you were using Photoshop?
Well, some not. I think Paint Shop Pro or something at the time.
Okay.
But yeah, just it was a very. A very manual process originally. But even the script, I mean, it was more of a pain. Now there's a lot of tools and it's very simple. But yeah, then it was a pain.
Well, other than and we could talk more about the development side of the website, Justin, because I know you later went on to make the famous purple version of Planet GameCube. Was it was or was that still Planet in 2000? I can't remember.
I don't remember.
We at one point we went from green to purple. It must have been for Planet GameCube because the GameCube was purple, and that was their logo, and that was the style that Nintendo chose for the system. And so, yeah, we had a purple website for a couple of years, and it was very distinctive. It really stood out, and I think, you know, it as strange as it might sound now, I think it did us a lot of good at the time. But I'm curious if you had a lot of memories of sort of maybe a one meta layer above the coding of the website, but more in terms of layout, functionality, how we were going to be formatting different kinds of articles, what kinds of content we were going to be making. I know that you were really involved in at least one big discussion that I remember, which was when this would have been in early 2001, when I was more involved with the website by that point. I'd been around for a little while, but I wasn't like a senior guy like you. And we were having a big internal staff debate about how to format reviews, because up to that point, there was nothing for us to review. And all of a sudden, we had Game Boy Advance coming out in a couple of months in Japan, and we had the GameCube coming out later that year. So this was suddenly, it was a new kind of article that we had to create from thin air for our website. And reviews, even today, are something that people have a lot of opinions about: what it should include, what it should not include, what kinds of scores do you have, how do you break all that down. Do you have any memory specifically of that discussion or one like it?
Not a lot of memories about the specific discussion, but I do know that I was always very opinionated about how it should be approached, and scores are important, but I never was really much of a fan of scores either at the same time. But the breakdowns, I'm sure I was very concerned with the breakdowns. And then, because the final format ended up being a very, you've got the long form review, and then there was this attempt to create the sort of short pro con. There always then the short pro con? So, yeah, you could have the bite size, get it out of the way quickly. And isn't that when you came to the page initially, that's what you'd see is the breakdown version, and then you could click and get to the big one.
I think we might have had some kind of like two page, or might have been that we had the main content on one page and then the scores on the second page, because we knew that a lot of people only cared about the scores.
Yeah,
but we wanted to kind of make people have to go through the text first, because we thought there was a chance that maybe then they'll read it. And plus, then we could get two clicks instead of one, which when you're an advertising, supported website, that helps.
Yeah, I mean, it's so long ago. and then trying to differentiate it from other sites that I've done. I mean, I think what we ended up using was at least similar to stuff that I had, at least in terms of setup, to what had been on 64 Source. So I'd imagine I would have mostly been interested in some consistency, just because it had worked. I can imagine I probably was contentious and difficult, as I usually would have been about something like that. Nothing really jumps out, thinking about it. It would have been. I definitely would have been one of the people in favor of trying to force people to actually read the content of what was there, and not just make it so easy to get the bite size. Though the bite size is important because people do search that out. But yeah, I probably would have been one of the people saying, "Yeah, we should make them read the whole damn thing first. Don't just let them see the score and move on." And I think that was why the pro con. I was probably really big on the pro con, because then at least have something there that, gets beyond just the scores. Maybe they can read something. The score by itself is so useless. It really means very little. Mm-hmm. You should at least be able to summarize or get an idea of what the major issues are with it.
I think at the time I was advocating for us to go without scores, because on my previous website, The Informant, I had not given scores, and I kind of thought that was better, but I was kind of a radical in that sense, and that may be a somewhat more popular or understandable position now, but at the time, I think it was considered kind of a crazy, extreme way to do a review, and a lot of people, perhaps correctly, felt that it was important for us to have scores. Like people would not even read our reviews at all if we didn't have a score. Like they just wouldn't take us seriously at all, because it was
One,
kind of the standard at the time.
I could see me being resistant to that, only especially at the time, because I think if I had to guess, my approach to that would have been that it's a potential, not that it's deliberate, but it's potentially sort of a cop out that you're able to then not really put your foot down and say exactly what you feel. You're leaving it to be inferred where you're coming in at, and somebody then can't. Because I think, because I have this thing, I do it now, when, because I'm a manager in my job, and it's not so much when I review people that I work with, it's when I, even when I look to get reviewed, it's a really weird thing. Like I'm really bothered by, and it happens in all areas. But like when people review games, a 10 and a 1, people don't like to give out 10s. People don't like to give out 1s. You probably barely ever would ever see a 1. And yet 1s should exist, and there really should be more of them. At some point, the way I really view the world with the reviews should be, you should be grading everything on a continuum. And so if there are 100 games and you have a 10-point rating system, 10 games should be in every category, because there really are 10 ones. There should be 10 ones. They are the 10 worst games that you've ever played. And it should be approached that way rather than sort of the arbitrary thing. Everybody's polite. I don't think anybody gives any lower than a 3, probably. And 3 would be sort of really, you're really dragging somebody through the mud if you give them a 3. But it's really not an honest score. If you really looked at it and you said, this is absolutely one of the worst games I've ever played, then why aren't you giving it a 1? I mean, and so I think I don't think my philosophy on that had developed so much back then, but I think that was sort of a precursor to the way I look at things now. And to get into that thing of not giving it an actual score, it's a cop out in a sense that you're not committing. And then the other part of it that would bother me is then, if you don't look at my body of reviews. If you look at my body of reviews and you're unable to see that I gave out far too many tens or far too many threes or far too many fives, that starts to sort of point a picture of my credibility. Like to me, if I'm not, you're not seeing a sort of a continuum of scores, and you're not seeing variation of any kind. It's just everything's great, everything sucks, everything's just, down the middle. You're not really doing a very good job reviewing. I mean, it might be that you're just happening to review a bunch of 7 games, but more likely you're not doing a very good job of communicating or evaluating these things in a more broad light. It's like I said, I don't like the idea that an 8 game, that there's a lot of 8 games out there. It shouldn't have to break down perfectly the way I'm describing with, 10 of each. But it should be close to that.
So you're definitely not a proponent of like the bell curve, which is probably
No.
what more of us think about, whereas like most things fall around the middle and you have some outliers that hit the kind of extremes on the outside. But there's an expectation that most things probably are at least okay.
Yeah. And it, which is in its own way, I guess it's more fair to developer. I mean, if you and maybe this goes back to the days of 64 source, that we weren't getting anything for free, and we didn't have a relationship with any
Yeah,
developer.
you
So
weren't
that,
worried about if someone who worked on the game read your review and tried to call you out on it or
if
something.
I'm hurting your feelings, I don't owe you anything. And I don't know, now there would be a part of me now that I do understand. I do understand through talking to different people and knowing different people that work in the industry that giving their game a 1, I could see I would feel really bad about it. But let's put it out there. Like BMX Triple X, if there was ever a game that deserved a one,
you gave it a five, by the way.
Well, but
you reviewed it and you gave it a five.
I so greatly enjoyed ripping it apart, but the five was a matter of filling in that expectation. I mean, it was a five in a sense that it was a game that was created and that people spent a lot of money to create. It was an awful piece of garbage. But the five is that thing of saying people spent a lot of time making this terrible game.
It works. It just doesn't work.
It's a functioning game. It is playable.
Yeah.
I suppose there may be people out there that may enjoy it for whatever reason. Being a very weak, Tony Hawk-ish game with a bunch of juvenile potty humor and an M rating that, promises some smut but delivers very little. Mm-hmm. Some scores dancers and light lesbian kissing. Is that really what I'm paying for? I always look back on that review. I enjoyed that review so much, just to sort of facetiously approach it from, I'm buying this game because it's M-rated and it's going to be raunchy and awesome. Mm-hmm. Now, where's my raunch? Where was the basis on which it was sold and pitched?
Yeah. What they were hoping was that people would buy it because they expected it to be really raunchy.
And that's what didn't make sense about it. It's like, wait a minute, I'm 18. I can buy hardcore porn. Some strippers, most of the time clothed, in skimpy outfits, perhaps. And like I said, some light lesbian kissing. That's not raunchy, folks. And it was such a weird marketing. Like, they put so much into marketing and being offensive, and they got people's hackles up for so little. I mean, the payoff was so sad. And
they lost their celebrity and endorser, Dave Mira, that game was originally Dave Mira's Dave Mira XXX, and then he got kind of spooked by the direction they were taking it, and he bailed.
Well, good for him, because
maybe he also played it.
Yeah, I mean, and then just the whole principle of it, over time I can get it so that my female bike rider will be topless. Mm-hmm. Design flaw.
That's like the ultimate reward in the game, though. I think you have to play it for 20 hours or something to unlock that.
But think of the fact that I'm playing from third person,
from behind,
behind camera. Right. So I can't even see her sadly polygonal boobs.
She's got a pretty back.
Yeah, yeah. I can see her butt. Oh joy! Most of it obscured by a bicycle seat. This is thrilling, boy.
Well, Justin, it might warm the cockles of your heart to know that our website has given, as of this recording, 7 reviews with a score of 1.
Yay!
And another dozen or so with a 1.5, and that's nice. Even before you get into the twos. Now, interestingly enough, there was only one of these back in the heyday of Planet GameCube, which was Jeff Shirley's fairly well-known and infamous, and I think still hilarious to this day, review of Charlie's Angels for GameCube. That was the first score of 1 that we ever did, and I was worried about it at the time. This was when I was running the site. I was kind of concerned about if we might get backlash, but I thought his review was so hilarious that we ran with it, and I don't really think we had too much negative response to it. And then all the rest of the scores of 1 have been since 2012. So it may be that we are, that as a whole, the staff are coming around to your way of thinking that we should use the entire scales. I don't know if that was done deliberately or if it's just sort of a natural evolution of the way people think about games over time. But
I think it's probably tough for a site to actually do, because especially if you were given the game by a publisher, they're not giving you a game with the expectation that you are going to completely dismantle what they worked on. And so that is a difficult thing for a site that's being given press materials.
If you have integrity, you should give an honest review without regard to how it's going to be taken by a company or how it might affect your relationship. Like, you should be able, that should be someone else's problem. That should not be the reviewer's problem.
We'll see, but it would have been easy for me because I didn't go, I wouldn't go to E3 anyway, so I don't even have to worry about running into these people. it might be tougher if you're at E3 and you're like, hey, oh shit, you're that guy that
I've had a few experiences along those lines, I have to say. It can be a little uncomfortable at parties. But Justin, I wanted to kind of start to wrap things up by talking about what your work slash site slash like life balance was back in the early 2000s and what eventually led you to leave the website, which as far as I can tell, you left around the time that Billy left for his job at Game Informer in the spring of 2003. So basically, I don't think I was ever your boss. I think you quit the website right as I was taking charge of the website back in 2003.
For obvious reasons.
Yeah, because I'm a jerk.
Well, I would imagine the whole time leading up to leaving, I was probably tapering down and down and down. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, one of the things with... I'd quit the sites I'd done because I was having a child. By the time I was leaving, that would have been probably about the time that I knew that I had a second kid on the way. Mm-hmm. So that would have been a big factor. But then within the first couple of years at the job that I got after losing my job because of the site, I was really quickly getting a lot. I was getting up and up and up, doing a lot more impactful things with them. So my real job really was getting to the point where between having a family, focus on the other stuff, the website stuff was just, I was struggling to really be consistent. And it was just, I think when you're working on sites like that, you need to be heavily into it or it's just not worth it. Because I mean, I've even dabbled with potentially trying to come back at certain points just to write some stuff. And it's usually just there's a lull somehow in my life for like a month or two that fools me into thinking, hey, you know, maybe you have time for this. And it just doesn't work out. That just, you know, work comes back, you know, some huge project comes along and it just, you can't commit enough to it. So it's just time to sort of wrap it up.
Well, I don't have kids of my own, at least not yet, but I always was pretty impressed that you were able to do anything for the website, having, being married and having a child. And I think it's telling that to this day, we have had very, very few staff members ever in the history of the website who've had children.
Yeah.
It's very hard to do. I mean, it's hard to work on this website, period, when you have a full-time job or even a part-time job or you're going to college. It takes a lot out of you. When you add an active family life on top of that, it's hard for me to even imagine how you did it at all.
Well, when they're young, it's easier. And when in the very first part, it was partially easier because I was married and we had a kid, but my wife wasn't around basically because when we first had her, we worked different shifts. She worked third shift. So, you know, there was not a lot of family time to be had, at least, you know, not with the three of us. I would take care of Allie at night and then, you know, have her overnight, drop her off with Tammy, and then, you know, it was just this cycle. We would just see each other for the drop off, and sometimes eat a meal together 5 days out of the week. So I think that was a sort of unique circumstance where I only had to take care of Allie, and I didn't have a lot else to do. So, you know, I had time in that window during that period. So yeah, probably the other thing is, you know, then when Tammy was no longer working third shift, you know, got to spend time with my wife. So it just sort of kept chipping away. Yeah, because now, you know, until my kids are out of the house, I just can't see how, I can't see how I could do anything more than, on occasion, just, you know, throw up a review or something, because it's just, life gets too crazy too quickly. and there's so many variables, especially with kids. I might be a bit more challenged with mine than most, but yeah, just stuff happens out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. And now it's, I've got stuff to work on now. So yeah.
Yeah. Well, I certainly can't blame you for that. What do you remember, like, on what terms you left the site? Was it just, hey, this has gotten too much, I need to walk away? You know, was it, you know, did Billy try to keep you around? Did you guys argue over it, or was it just, hey, I get it, go take care of your business, thank you for everything?
Yeah, I think it was more of a, like, it was obvious to anybody that I had sort of hung around longer than, I mean, because it was a weird thing that I'd even, after, you know, after sort of shutting down my sights, in theory, I could have just stopped then. Mm-hmm. So then, I got involved with the new site and was still writing stuff on occasion. All of a sudden wrote the back end for the new site, and I was heavily involved. So, you know, it was like I had sort of almost multiple lives over the course of that whole time, you know, longer than probably, you know, anybody would have expected. So yeah, by the time I was ready to hang it up, I think it was overdue. I think everybody was like, yeah, if you gotta go do your thing, you go do your thing. Then I imagine I just sort of disappeared. I imagine it wasn't even like this big thing. It was just sort of like, okay, now I'm just not writing anything anymore. All right.
Yeah. Well, after the latest thing I could find from you was a review in March of 2003. And then as far as I can tell, you didn't write for the site. You might have participated in like a blah, blah, blah kind of, you know, like chat discussion in the round or something like that. But as far as I can tell, you didn't write another article for the site until 2009, which would have been the 10-year anniversary.
Yeah.
And it's called, the title is Jesus, I'm Old. And I just want to point out that was 6 years ago. is always relative, right?
Well, and now I just measure old by the fact that my my oldest daughter is a sophomore in high school. So, your kids are in high school and then soon she's going to be graduating. Yeah, it's my age is measured now on the age of my kids. It's like, yeah, I'm old.
Well, what is your oldest daughter, you know, having been a baby or a toddler, you know, back in the days of when you were really active in the website, is she aware that you were involved in this big kind of organization that was sort of, you know, larger than any of us individually? Is she interested in the legacy of it at all?
No, we don't talk about it too much. I mean, you know, obviously our house always has the newest Nintendo system, without fail. And both girls have, their own Game Boys and they always pretty much have. I mean, when the DS, first came out, I remember being fascinated that, it was a WarioWare Touch that, I mean, Allie was so young, and yet, there were a couple of the mini games in that. They were essentially just, you know, popping balloons kind of thing, with the touch interface. And I was really fascinated by how approachable, you know, so it's not like I could really talk to her about it, about what she was supposed to do. I just sort of put it in front of her. And you know, when the stuff would show up on the screen, I would just start touching the screen in those places and they'd pop and it would make a noise or whatever. And she was instantly, you know, sucked in and she was engaging in this thing. So Nintendo stuff was always sort of this thing. And she's hugely into Animal Crossing and stuff. she's looking forward to Christmas and getting the design, the Animal Crossing, the new one,
the Happy Home designer.
The Happy Home. Yeah. She is all about that. So that'll be funny. But in terms of her understanding it, she knows I used to work on the sites and stuff like that, but it's just not something that comes up a lot. And it's one of those things that if I tried to tell her, what it was or anything like that without like really trying to be sort of a self-important idiot about it. You know, I used to run these. So without doing that, all I can think is that, maybe at some point if she asked or just simply discovered would be the only way that it ever would, really be revealed in any significant way to her.
Don't think she's ever Googled daddy's name and read some of the stuff that you used to write?
Probably not. I don't know.
I've never Googled my dad's name, but there's nothing to find. But I don't know if I was that age. I don't even know if that would occur to me to try it.
Yeah, not that I know of. And it would be funny if she did. I don't think she'd be surprised by me thoroughly being me. over explaining everything and being kind of an opinionated jerk about whatever I felt like being a jerk about. I don't think any of that would be shocking exactly. It's funny. It would be interesting sometimes to go, especially like some of the old forum people, the people that go back along the way. It would be interesting to talk to just some of those people because, and I don't know if you have maybe you don't have the experience so much since you've probably encountered people with E3 or stuff like that. I've had very few interactions with anybody tied to the site in any significant way. So it's like, when it comes to things like significance, I would only guess. Like I really don't know. Like I don't. Like it's weird once in a while when I'll run into, when I used to run into a comment about something I'd said. And a lot of times it was just tangential that I'd written something that they were cross-linking. But once in a while there'd be something where somebody would have some opinion about me, and it was always sort of weird to read. Because I never really thought about the feedback loop. I just sort of kept writing and having an opinion and not really thinking about what people's response would be. So it would be weird. And, at work, we have a 360 review every once in a while where people tell you, either what they think you do right or do wrong. It would be interesting to do such a thing, to understand what people actually thought of what anybody had done. I don't know. Other than I would imagine people thought I was opinionated for better or worse. It would be an interesting experience.
Well, I hope one day you'll be able to, hand a copy of the book to your family and say, this is something I was a part of and people really care about it. And it's still around and it has, lived on, way past your time with it. But, You did a lot of things, Justin, back in the day that had very lasting impacts on me and many, 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 many other people. So I think you've probably affected people in ways that you can't imagine. I'm going to try to capture some of that for you.
That'd be cool.
Before we go, I'm trying to ask this of people when I interview them. Is there anything you want to ask me, and anything you've wondered about the website that I might be able to answer, or anything like that?
Longer ago, maybe I would have had more questions. I mean, it's literally just so far in the rearview mirror. It's like I've gone to the site like once in a while just to read something random. And and it seems to still be doing the same kind of deal.
Make you feel to see that it's still there, and even the stuff that you did for like Operation in 2000, you can still find it?
Yeah, no, and once in a while, like the one that I'll go back to is that BMX Triple X, just because I remember enjoying having so much fun. It's one of those things. It's like one of the greatest gifts as a reviewer to not be just given a mediocre game, because mediocre games are hard to write because you can't completely destroy them. They're bad and they're not the most wonderful thing, but they do have merits. So you feel like, at least being polite about it. But it's truly beautiful when you get a terrible game, because it brings out that like creative streak of, okay, I've got a diagram for posterity how terrible this is.
It gets to be a little more colorful too with your descriptions of it and everything.
Yeah, there's more fun to be had. But as and once in a while I'll find some old editorial and it'll make me laugh. It'll just I was like I was such a dick. It just there's just something funny about that. But aside from that, I just don't. I don't even pay much. Life is life. So, and like I said, that's just all so far in the rearview mirror now. I'm glad that it's continued to go. And wasn't Jonathan Lindemann running things for a little while?
He was, and he's still around. He's still he does the podcast Radio Free Nintendo, and John and I did that together for over 7 years.
Wow. Well, and he's got to be getting, because he was the release date guy. I mean, so
for N64 HQ, yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, he is way back.
Yes, John's been doing this stuff for like almost 20 years.
Yeah, I mean, that's commitment. That's like, yeah. Geez. Oh, because I still have connections to Ty or Brian Dawson through like Facebook and stuff. So, they're doing their own thing, and it is fascinating to see them still being themselves. Like Brian cracks me up. Just he's still thoroughly himself, I think that's what's really cool with still having a connection to some folks that just, that they're authentic. They're authentic people. They really, they weren't putting up a front. They weren't projecting a different persona of themselves. They are themselves. They wrote as themselves. Mm-hmm. And there's something to that. And that is something that, in those things of whether or not professional sites are the same or not. I wouldn't know because I never met them. It's neat knowing that the people that you work with and that wrote stuff, that it was all authentic and that they were really the people they are.
it is amazing to find out that Ty Sugard is a real person.
he's a trip. He's funny.
Well, Justin, I think you're someone who was to some extent, or at least the extent of your involvement with the site was a bit behind the scenes. And I don't know that you've ever really gotten proper credit. And I don't know that the people who just read the site and followed it probably fully appreciated everything that you brought to it. But I'm hoping to change that a little bit and kind of give people a little bit more background on what you did and guys like you, I think this interview is a pretty good showcase for what kind of person you are and why you were so influential back then. So thanks so much for doing this, Justin, and no problem. I hope this won't be the last time we get to talk.
Sure. All right.